Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hi, Shireen.
Hi, Anna. Wow, we have a great episode for y'all today.
We do. You know what? We have a great guest today. We have Hina Wilkerson on this episode. You might know Hina as the co-host of They Called Me Papa. Or you might know Hina just because you know Hina and maybe you grew up in Hawaii together. Hard to say, you know what? We'll find out, won't we?
Yeah, it's a really good conversation. Hina is really generous with her time and her brain. And I encourage you to do your own learning after hearing this episode. So don't go anywhere.
Who are we? Where do we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Okay, wow. Welcome to Ethnically Ambiguous. I am Shireen.
And I'm Anna.
And we are part... I can't do that. I was going to try to play along, but I laughed immediately.
Or Anna. Anna as well, I guess.
I did watch that video from the Daily Zeitgeist live show, which was hilarious. But Miles calls you Anna. No, Miles calls you Anna, and Jack calls you Anna.
Mm-hmm.
Which is...
just how I like it.
Yeah. And I try to call you Anna as much as I can, but I just call you both at this point. It doesn't really matter.
Maybe I should, just because, you know, when you meet people and you say their name, they're like, well, it's actually pronounced this way. And you're like, oh, okay. But like, sometimes they come in hot and you're like, whoa, okay. So maybe I want to be kind of intense about it. Maybe moving forward, I'll be like, it's Anna.
And I imagine you like, when like, it's in the middle of a handshake and you tighten your grip, you know? It's
yeah,
like
actually,
that.
Like now that I've really just explained that situation, I'll never do that. I have no energy. Who cares?
Oh, that's fair, I guess. I was excited for a minute.
I just don't care.
Confrontation.
I know. So I'll just do it to you. How about that?
I'm always waiting to fight someone. I wish I could just fight someone all the time. I don't know what's wrong with me.
Are you watching the Nicole Kidman vehicle Nine Perfect
Strangers?
No, I'm not.
Okay,
there's a character you might like in there who also is like, she just wants to like punch pretty girls. And I just think that's really funny.
Related. Yeah, I can understand that. I just want to really just get it out. And also just like yesterday, I'm working on a shoot and I found out that one of the crew members is unvaccinated, even though I told them it's required. And
cool vibe.
He emails me back just saying, actually, I'm unvaccinated. I will get a test though. Even though my email says you have to be vaccinated. Huh. So I found someone, I didn't email him right away. I had to find someone to replace him first. And that's pretty hard on like a low budget ASAP thing. And then I found someone. And writing this email was the most joy I have felt in a really long time.
Wow.
I was like.
That's wild.
Thanks for your time. But we're only allowing vaccinated people on set. And I was going to say good luck out there. And that felt too aggressive. So I took that out. I really liked sending that out.
You're like, good luck out there, you motherfucker. Good luck.
Yeah. Huh. That's okay.
Fun.
It's fun to be angry. It's time to bring in our guest. We've done enough chit-chatting. I can't believe I said chit-chatting. Our guest today was introduced to us by a mutual friend, and it's Hina Wilkerson.
Hello. Hi. Hello. I'm also really confrontational. I'm glad that you are too.
It makes me feel alive. I don't really feel alive a lot. And that me feel alive.
Well, if you ask my boyfriend though, he'd be like, no, you fall apart instantly. But for the rest of the world, oh, I'm combative. But when hit, I'm like, wait, why did you raise your voice a little bit? Stop.
I mean, if I'm fighting with my parents, it's like a fight cry. Like I cry immediately when it comes to family stuff, which is like, I feel like a baby, but I'm still angry doing it. It's like an angry cry.
Yeah. The rage is inside the water.
Yeah.
I'm combative with my dad, but anything he says that could be even remotely harsh, I'm like, why do you hate me? And then, you know, but he's like, you literally started, you came in so hot to begin with. So how is this my fault? And I'm like, you're the adult.
It's the only weapon I have. Tears.
Yeah.
Oh, great. It's so nice having emotions.
Is it?
yes,
I could do without
any. I think I have too many, and I'm either trying to repress them or they're all flooding out.
You're falling for the immigrant parent propaganda machine that you have too many emotions. It's like
all my family is like, "How do you feel so much?" And I'm like, I don't know.
It's propaganda, Shereen. Yeah. It's part of the system to bring you down and oppress you. You do not listen to that kind of crap, okay?
Yeah. Your emotions are valid. That's how I defeat colonizers is I cry.
Yes.
Yeah.
I like the idea of like an immigrant parent propaganda machine. It's like, I mean, if you don't become a doctor, lawyer, an engineer, you will die in the streets. And you're like,
yeah, it works though. It works for a lot of people.
What's the evidence supporting this? They're like, don't worry about it.
Yeah. But if you step outside, if you go to a party, you will be a drug addict.
If you step outside, immediately a drug addict. Yeah. You're like,
go to one party, you're toast.
God, it works so well.
Yeah.
Anyway, so thank you for joining us. Yes, so Lauren Cassell of Tink Media and Hark Audio. Tink. Lauren does so much. I don't know. Emails me, she's like, I've got this new venture. And I'm like, of course.
She's
you
so
do.
Incredible. We met at, there was a bunch of breakout groups at Podcast Movement in Nashville. Yeah. And I went to this BIPOC Women in Podcasting session. And it was all of the brown people in the entire convention.
Beautiful.
And
beautiful.
Lauren. And we were all like listening to this wonderful woman. It was like really empowering and it felt like a safe space. And I asked, how do we grapple with the label BIPOC when it can be so unifying, but it also makes white people feel like they've really done something?
Yeah.
You know, they're like, why do you need like a Black empowerment group and a Latinx empowerment group and a blah, blah, blah? Like, you're all under the umbrella of BIPOC. Like, here's your candy and shut the fuck up. And then she came up to me afterwards and we started talking and she's lovely and wonderful. And that's how I know you guys.
That's a real white ally right there.
Oh, you know? Yes. Yes.
That's a real one. It's a real one.
We need people to be vetted.
The way you phrase that question, it makes me think of like the, this is a very broad comparison, but the ABC's reaction. God, this is so, I'm so sorry I'm bringing this up. But ABC, like the network's reaction to Shonda Rhimes, asking for one more ticket to Disneyland. And the executive said to her, don't you have enough? And then
she's
like,
wait, I don't know about this.
And I'm going to Netflix to make the biggest streaming show ever on Netflix. So you should have just given me that damn Disneyland ticket. So I don't know. I always think of that.
Shit.
I always think of that like, oh, you
when
just.
When did that happen?
Well, I've never heard of this.
It's the theory. Now, this is just, you know, of course, you just read it online. It's a theory as to why she left ABC.
I see.
And
went to
sign
a development deal with Netflix. And then came out with Bridgerton, like the horniest show. And then all the ladies were like, ABC who, you know?
And then I love our Lord and Savior, Shonda Rhimes, but I've tried to do the Bridgerton. I just can't. I've started it like 3 different times and
I haven't started it at all. So you're better than me.
You have to kind of suspend your disbelief and really just like, you just have to like want to be horny. Like you want to like see this dude, this like prince. What is he? Dutch?
Oh, I've seen the photos.
Duchess?
I enjoy the
Duke?
Stills.
The Duke. Okay, whatever. I got
He's
Duchess.
All right. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, but you have to let yourself go and be like, I am going to accept that I'm watching a romance novel on TV and I'm going to be like, oh my God.
Yeah.
And you just have to let yourself go into that world, which is like not really a thing I do because I don't really like casually read romance novels.
Yeah.
And it's not like necessarily my like, automatic like genre of choice if I'm watching something, not to be like, I just want to be as horny as possible, you know?
Yeah.
But like, I just let myself go. And there were moments where I was like, what?
Steamy.
Okay.
And then I was like,
I'll try to do that.
Am I? Oh my God.
I mean,
it's like an awakening
off,
in my. You know.
Yeah. I got to turn off like the cynical, emotionally dead part of me. That's just like, I don't want to touch anyone ever.
Yeah,
and
I had
like
to do
kind
that.
Of invite it.
Yeah, well, I'll wait till I'm wet and then I'll turn on the first episode.
Well, that
to, like,
actually might be too much. You might not be able to handle it if you go in. Okay. If you go in horny.
Then it's overwhelming for a different reason.
I must warn you.
Okay.
It's like I did the same thing for that Netflix show, Sex Life, which Shereen and I have spoken about on this show. Didn't hit the same. That one when I was like, okay, first of all, I don't know what you guys think this is, but you can't be doing this on TV.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, yeah. I think I'll you were open-minded from Bridgerton.
I was.
You came in, yeah. And you were, not everything is, that Shonda Rhimes is Shonda Rhimes.
Oh, yeah. Know? She yeah. can be no wrong.
You got to be careful. Look, you can't, not everything Netflix does in the like sexy romance department is appropriate. That one, it was straight up like, with it by episode 3, there was a huge, huge full frontal dong that I was like, what the fuck?
You're that's just the only part
show
I've
a huge ass dick with zero like reasoning. And
like
then
a
also,
flaccid dick?
Hard to say because it was so big. It was hard. Oh. It was so, okay, I'll just tell you right now. Episode 3, 1950. Just go look at it. Sex life.
Yeah. That's exactly what she told me. That's the only part I've seen.
Because that's all that matters.
It is jarring. It is unsettling. It's just like,
okay.
I don't recommend the show. It makes no sense. The main character is this Persian woman, Sarah Shahi. That's why I watched it originally. Because I was like, okay, I could fuck with Sarah Shahi. First of all, they're trying to act like she's white. She's got the whitest
really?
Kids I've ever seen in the show. It's like, that's not how Persian genes work. Like, that child would have some sort of color in their skin. Like,
yeah.
You're not just like all the, you don't have a platinum blonde white child if you're a Persian woman. It makes no matter how white your husband is, it's just yeah. not possible. In my opinion, maybe it is, but like, I really don't believe it. I just don't believe it. So that kind of irked me to begin with. And then it was like a huge dong for no reason because you don't see it any other point. It's just to prove a point that this guy has a huge dick. But it's so big that it's just stupid. It's just stupid at that
Dicks
point.
Dicks can be too big. That's not a controversial opinion. Dicks can be too big.
Yeah. The little that I did see, their version of sexy time is very aggressive and almost like uncomfortable. Like, I feel like, I don't know. That's my, I've also watched very little, but. It made me uncomfortable. Okay, enough about other people having
giant
sex
dicks. Yeah.
Other than us. Yeah.
I'll bring this up whenever I can. I just need to talk about this big dick that I saw.
It has to come up two more times in the episode.
Shook me to my core.
After you sent it to me, I sent it to like my sister, my friends. I was like, go to this. This is crazy.
I sent it to everyone I knew. I was like, episode 3, 1950. Can you go please let me know your thoughts on this? Because it's not okay in my opinion.
Yeah.
You have to create a story around a huge dong, okay? It just can't be like, shock factor, hashtag tweet about it. It's like, go fuck yourself, Netflix. How dare you?
How dare you?
I'm still mad.
Still mad. Hina.
Yes.
Anyways. I want to know about, I want to rewind. Let's, that's not a rewind sound. I want to rewind. Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Hawaii on Oahu Island, which is the main island with like Waikiki and Diamond Head. And that's what most people picture when they think of Hawaii. And I have a single mom and three brothers. And I didn't leave home until 23 when I moved to New York. So all of my childhood, all of my early memories, like were growing up on an island, which is so like, obviously it's different than growing up on the continent. But I don't think I really appreciated how different my life was until I moved here. And I felt kind of like a fish out of water. But yeah, it was a trip. And a lot of my like early childhood memories were I grew up in the sovereignty movement. So like not everybody knows that Hawaii is an occupied kingdom, essentially. And it's under military occupation. And
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's really, really depressing when you think about the history. America literally just like decided to be like, this is ours now.
World. Yeah.
Like they hadn't like there was a queen at the time, right? Or was that her title?
Yes. Yeah. So yeah. the overthrow didn't happen until like 1893. And basically what happened was that like a bunch of businessmen lied to the president and said that American lives were at stake and something was happening to them. So then they all brought the military to Hawaii and then they locked the queen up under house arrest in her room for eight months.
Cool.
And then they were like, you guys are ours now. And so now there's a lot of, and there always has been a lot of political talk about how to basically restore the nation. A lot of the bones of Hawaii are still from the kingdom. So like the Supreme Court building, the largest U.S. postal office, like all of those are just kingdom buildings that are now quote unquote state buildings. So the bones of of everything are still very much there. So it's a really jarring experience. Yeah. It's strange.
I mean, we touched on this very briefly in another episode recently, but we were talking about how Hawaii is, or I'm saying it not the way I'm supposed to say it, but
it's
like,
okay. Totally okay.
the people in charge, or like whoever, like the Americans involved, like their priority is tourism. And it feels like the actual indigenous people and people that were descendants of this kingdom, and now it's like whatever, it's they either have to work in tourism or they get gentrified and they have to leave. They can't afford something because like there's new stuff being built. I just think it's so fucking sad. And I mean, I can't deny it. I want to go to Hawaii one day. But
oh,
like,
sure. Yeah.
But it's at the same time, that's when people think of Hawaii, they think of like a great vacation.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's what's weird about being here. Like, I can't really... This is a weird territory to tread on, because every minority group on the continent in America struggles to varying degrees for different reasons. And so, not to compare, but I think the difficulty that I find like talking about Hawaiians, but also Pacific Islanders more broadly, is that people don't really consider that anything could be bad.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it's like, you know, when I hand somebody my ID, when I buy food at 7 or I buy beer at 7-Eleven, like 50% of the time people comment on my ID and they want to talk about Hawaii and I was at a wedding there last year and blah, blah, blah. And so it's kind of hard to even convince people that like my life hasn't been perfect and that we mm-hmm. aren't just like happy and excited and
living on an island and eating
tropical fruit. Oh my God, why are you even here? So it's weird to talk about. Because everyone, like the stereotypes are positive in a toxic way.
Yeah. It's like you guys are on different planets. Like, it's,
yes.
Your view of your home is completely different than like a tourist point of view or like someone that has no idea, like even about the history. I think the history is like not talked about at all. Even in school, it's just one of the states, you know? It's not, I don't know.
Well, some people don't even know that you can be Hawaiian. And so there's this like conversation, even in Hawaii, which is kind of weird, where people will come and they like retire from Arizona or whatever, and they move and they have lived there maybe for 20 years. And so then people will say like, well, I consider myself Hawaiian, which is so insane to me. like they can't comprehend that like I could live in Japan my whole life. Like, I'm not going to become Japanese. Like, you can't become an ethnicity because you spend a lot of time there. But then they'll argue with you about it. Like, well, I feel the spirit.
Have you gotten into those arguments? Like, you yourself as someone from Hawaii?
1,000%.
Oh, my God.
1,000%.
So you, well, like, if you feel the energy, you're like Hawaiian?
Well,
that's why.
And it seems dumb. Like, yeah, it seems
but
dumb,
say
but
that kind of stuff.
I just can't imagine trying to validate that in front of someone who is Hawaiian. You know what I mean? Like,
I think
what
it comes from
like?
You say that you're. I think it comes from people saying that, like, oh, I'm a Californian or I'm an Arizonan, and so they think that, oh, that's like what it is to be Hawaiian, is like just to say that. I mean, because people can be from Hawaii and not be Hawaiian.
I mean, they're also gentrifying that word then.
Yeah,
they're whitewashing
exactly.
that word. And that's
just, I feel it. Yeah. I want to change it.
So, okay. So if a person is actually, their ethnicity is Hawaiian, what do you call people who live there but aren't technically Hawaiian? Like that.
So if you are from Hawaii and you were born there, you would be called a kama'aina, you're a local. And then if you're a visitor, you would be a malihini, which literally just means visitor. Mm-hmm. And the word haole gets talked about a lot because it literally means foreigner, which means anyone that isn't from Hawaii,
mm-hmm.
Chinese, Japanese. But like in a colloquial sense, it means white person.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So you would say, oh, that person's haole.
There's a word like that in Arabic too. Technically, ajanib. It's like technically it means just someone like a foreigner, but now it's just like white people. You know, it's just like I understand. Like technically, if you look it up, like this is what it means. And like with time, it's become just like a white person term.
Do people get offended by the term? Like, do white people get offended by the term?
When you're growing up mostly in America, then you visit like your parents' country. Sometimes you're like the American cousin or the white cousin or whatever. And I'm not fucking white, but yeah. they group together America and whiteness. And I got really irritated every time they did that because I'm not either of those things in my head. But I do think like the average white person wouldn't understand. They would just think it's foreigner. It honestly depends on the way they say it. The okay. way they say it has a lot to do with it.
Well, and that's what Hale is too. But some people say, I mean, this is fringe, but there are people that relate it to a really derogatory word. Mm. Like it's a slur almost, which it is not. Just like anything else, right? Mm-hmm. Like you could, if you say you effing Hale on the beach, it is a slur. Like yeah. they're trying to hurt your feelings, but it mm-hmm. you can also just refer to somebody like that. It doesn't inherently have any energy behind it. Mm-hmm. Which is weird being here now and being in a majority white place, not being from a really white, like white people are a minority in Hawaii. And here that is not the case, especially in Nashville, that's not the case. I'm far more aware of my otherness than I ever have before.
Right.
And so I feel in a lot of ways I'm grappling with now at 26 with some of the same feelings that people probably grapple with when they're just like maybe even toddlers going to preschool and being mm-hmm. the only brown kid. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of this like late stage semi-assimilation that I'm kind of experiencing.
Yeah. Right. And so your ethnicity is technically Hawaiian then.
So I'm Hawaiian, Black, Portuguese, German, and Irish.
I'm just curious, like your ancestors, like is the Portuguese, like what's from your mom's side and what's from your dad's side? I'm just literally.
Yeah.
Just, like,
so my dad is just Black.
Okay.
And my mom is everything else.
Wow.
And so my, like even like the white sides of my mom's family, like lived in Hawaii for a really long time. So my white great-great-grandparents came to Hawaii from Germany.
Oh.
And then my Portuguese great-great-grandparents came to Hawaii from Portugal, from the Azores. And then my Hawaiian family were there for thousands of years.
Right.
So everybody kind of early emigrated. And then...
What brought your dad to Hawaii?
So my dad, my mom... Like when she was 18, she dropped her name or she changed her name and she only had one name, like Malcolm X or Prince.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And then she took her motorcycle to the continent and like went touring on her motorcycle, like cross country.
Wow. She's a badass. I love
her.
She's
a cool bitch. Yeah. She's awesome. And then she was working in the kitchens at Hard Rock Cafe in Las Vegas and she met my dad.
Meet cute. We don't have those anymore.
They don't make them like they used to.
No. We want to ask so many questions, but first, let's take our first break. We forgot to do that early on. We're just so invested in this conversation. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. Hina did just refer to us as Dr. Phil, but she was joking, and I will get over it. How old were you when you went to the mainland for the first time?
The first time I can remember, I was 11.
Okay.
So my dad hasn't really been in my life, really my whole life, but like occasionally I'll see him. And so really that was a lot of what I was, when I went to the continent, it was for that. It was to go to Vegas, which of all the places to go to is
kind of interesting. Such a strange introduction. I mean, yeah. Like honestly, it's maybe the most American introduction.
Yeah. And so that was kind of weird for a lot of reasons. But what's interesting about Las Vegas specifically is that some people refer to it as like the ninth island because there's such a huge Hawaiian population in Las Vegas. I think it's the second highest populace-wise of Native Hawaiians besides Hawaii in Las Vegas. And when you get off the plane in Las Vegas, it says, Aloha, welcome to Las Vegas. Because they're trying to pander to us so aggressively. Because we can't gamble. So when you want to have like a cheap-ish vacation because flights are expensive, you go to Las Vegas and you have your crazy adventure for a week. But that was probably the first trip that I was thinking about, not in these terms, but what does it mean for me to like be Black and to be visually Black, but to have absolutely no understanding of anything? It just, it was strange. And the rules of engagement were totally different. And the subtext that I just could not understand, not just in the African-American community, but like in American culture more broadly and what the rules were.
Yeah, I don't, that sounds so overwhelming to even consider as like a teenager or like a young person, you know, it's, let alone trying to fucking therapize yourself as an adult, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just go back to all those things.
Did you have to deal with any colorism growing up like in Hawaii? Like, was that ever an issue?
No. I don't think that colorism is super present uh-huh. in Hawaii as a concept. If and when it does occur, it would be for people that are more fair, not for me.
Interesting.
So it's like kind of internalized
colorism.
Yeah, like internally kind of. in the inverse, right?
Yeah,
it's this like fear of not being Hawaiian enough.
I see. I actually,
that's
compared to so many cultures that prefer the opposite, like Arabs included, and like yeah. a lot of Swana countries included. That sounds refreshing, but I also think it's like I shouldn't say that out loud.
Well, it's like it's always greener, right? Because
right.
at first, like right after the overthrow, and even in like the early 1900s, when colonization was like really working in the islands, like industrialization and all those things.
Yeah.
There was a lot of shame about being Hawaiian. So,
yeah.
you know, they banned the language. They, mm-hmm. you know, everybody started to have English names. It was a lot of assimilation. Let's be whiter. And then the Hawaiian Renaissance happened. And then it was like this resurgence of you should be proud. You should, you know, you should speak Hawaiian. We shouldn't let the language die. You should name your kids Hawaiian. You should have them down to a lot, all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was this pride. And so then that created this kind of really subtle ways of being and like really strict, like far more boundaries around what it means to be a good Hawaiian and visual cues or activities that you do. Like it's a lot of proving that you're Hawaiian through the things that you do and the things that you like.
Like validating that you belong.
Right. Exactly.
Wow. That's exhausting. That sounds exhausting.
It is exhausting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, so when did you start going to school in the mainland? Like, was that 11 or is that like more of a back and forth thing?
No. So I never lived on the continent. I would only be there for like a week or two. So I didn't go to school here until I moved in 2018 to get my master's and I went to NYU.
Also, I'm going to try calling it the continent like you instead of mainland. Because that implies it's like a part of the mainland. I just realized that just now when you said continent. So look at me learning, growing. I'm not going to edit anything out. It's now I call it the continent.
Well, I'm glad.
Yeah. Thank you for not thinking I'm a terrible person for saying that initially.
Oh, no. I because it's still like people mostly say the mainland. It's just an easy thing
What's
to do.
What's crazy is that I thought I was saying it and I was like, good job, me.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm doing something right.
I think it's valid to be proud of yourself. I feel that way when I learn new things here. That I'm like, look at me. I'm growing and evolving.
Yeah. So everyone, call it the continent.
Yes.
Mainland implies...
Tell your friends.
It's part of the land. And it's really not. It's stolen.
Yeah, I think it came from this. I'm not going to remember it off the top of my head, but there was this Hawaiian poet that wrote a poem about Hawaii not being, or the mainland not being the mainland and it being the continent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how like the kind of daily linguistic resistance like that kind of became a part of the vernacular. So people try to say the continent. Yeah, it's a very
the
good
continent.
Poem.
Yeah.
You said the Hawaiian sort of renaissance. When was that? I don't know anything about that.
So there's been a couple of Hawaiian renaissances throughout the year. Like the first one would be still during the kingdom. And that's like a resurgence of like, let's start dancing hula again. Like, let's resist the banning of certain ways of dressing or, you know, so it was when it was still the kingdom. And then the kind of new Hawaiian Renaissance happened in the 70s. And that had to do a lot with, like, one of the islands is called Ko'olawe. And it was used as a bombing ground for the United States.
Huh. What?
Yeah. To test bombs, just like a bombing area.
Wow.
And they said they were going to clean it up. Spoiler alert, they didn't. And so now it's like you can't really inhabit it. There's still unexploded bombs on the land. And this group of Hawaiian activists, they like staged a sit-in on the island to get them to stop bombing. George Helm and a group of resistance fighters. And he, like, one of the thing that people still talk about very much so is that he and a friend like were paddling out like at sea to get help or something. I forgot the details, but they went missing at sea. And so it was that. It was the resurgence of Hawaiian language. And now there's Hawaiian preschools where the kids only speak Hawaiian. And like it brought it back from being a endangered language. And so now you can get your PhD in Hawaiian language. And yeah.
I want to try and pivot to you. Because I know, I mean, we could ask you about this all day.
Yeah,
I think you're a wealth of knowledge, and I would love to pick your brain. Maybe you can come on and talk to us about this only. But I don't want to make it seem like that's the only reason you're here, because that's not. So you come here when come to the continent when you're 18. 23, sorry. Yeah. At that point, did you have an idea of like your intentions of coming here, like what you wanted to pursue as a career or like what you were interested in?
So I got my master's in media, culture, and communication. And I always knew I was going to do something in creative stuff, whether that was writing, whether it was producing. I didn't really have an idea of where it was going to go, but I knew I wanted it to go in that direction. But I had never been to the East Coast. I had never been to New York. And I just got in a plane with my best friend and we moved. And my mom helped us and we brought all our stuff and we just hoped for the best. A lot of the things that I learned when I was in school was basically that in a lot of ways I was playing it safe.
Yeah.
And I like wanted to create, but it felt a lot safer to go into something that was theory-based. And I was like, well, maybe I'll just work in a firm or I'll be behind the scenes and I'll be happy to just be in a space that I enjoy. But I think being in New York and being at NYU and being so close to people that you know, are in film and movies and make podcasts and are in front of the camera, I think I was able to be a little bit more real with myself about that really being my desire. It just felt really crowded and it felt really saturated. And so the pandemic even kind of helped with that. Just being stuck, you realize that, I mean, the room is really crowded, but everybody's going to have to make some room because I'm trying to get in the door and kind of move my elbows about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, if my math is wrong. So you said that you moved to New York at 23 and now you're 26. So
yes,
most of your time here has been under a pandemic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. That's,
yeah.
I'm so sorry.
No. Well, and I think if I had been able to be in New York while I wasn't full-time in school and it wasn't a global pandemic, I think I would have warmed to the city.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just such a hard place to live.
Yeah.
It's so hard. And I'm sure that other places are, you know, it's not the only difficult place to live, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for the kind of person I am, it felt really stressful.
Mm-hmm.
So now I think having moved to Nashville a couple of months ago, which I did the same thing. I'd never been to the South. I'd never been to Nashville.
Why'd you choose Nashville?
We had a friend that was already living here. So a part of it was convenience. You know, you kind of have an inn in the city already. And it felt like something completely new. I think even traveling, I've spent the majority of my time going to the West Coast. And so I haven't lived there, but I've experienced it. And so the South kind of felt like, what can I do that is completely out of where I thought I would ever live? The South.
Yeah. Nashville's pretty cool though. So that's...
People are nice. Yeah. People are warm and welcoming and Yeah, it's been exciting. I'm glad that I moved here. But I mean, if you ask me again in a year, I don't know. But for now, it's great.
There is a very burgeoning and like consistent film scene there, for what I understand. I haven't been there yet, but it does seem like out of all the places, out of all the cities around that region, Nashville is kind of like a creative hub.
It definitely feels that way. Lots of art, lots of, it kind of feels like a Southern Portland. That's a strong statement, but it's approaching Portland.
I understand what you mean, though. Yeah. It's like, I feel like the Austin, Portland, and Nashville, I feel like I get the same vibe from them.
Yeah.
You know, and they can be differing levels of whatever I'm feeling, but.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of more mainstream Portland.
Yeah.
Definitely not as weird, but it's fun.
This is a recommendation for if maybe you've already been here, but the Lipstick Lounge.
No.
Great, great lesbian bar that has wonderful karaoke. Probably one of my favorite bars. It's just so fun.
That sounds fun.
It's I gotta go there.
I think it's in
I haven't
East
been to a
Nashville.
Gay bar yet, so. Well, a lesbian bar. Really, I haven't checked out the queer scene at all, really.
I mean, it's been hard to do that. So yeah. I understand.
To check out anything has been difficult.
Yeah. I really hope, I don't think there's no such thing as normal anymore. We're never going to get back to whatever quote unquote normal was.
No.
But I do hope to one day, like, be able to go out without having an anxiety attack. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's been hard to be real with yourself about how I think I've really been in denial about how much the pandemic affected me until like 2 weeks ago.
Oh.
I'm definitely like my modus operandi in life is to try to be unbothered, which is harmful, but.
Yeah. I want to ask about that.
Yeah.
But first, let's take our second break. Okay, we are back. I would love to kind of like pick your brain about how you started to realize like you were getting very affected by the world around you and the pandemic. Because I also have the problem of like really stuffing things down and not acknowledging them until it's like overflowing and I'm a mess. So please, can you tell me your experience?
I guess I just start by saying that I think the reason why I repress is because I think growing up in like such a politically charged environment, it always felt like the most important thing is to get the job done, to fight for the greater purpose, to resist, oppress, show up, don't let people see you cry, be strong. And I think that those lessons are really valuable, but it's also made me put all of my personal emotions and all the things that I feel on the back burner because it always feels like I'll get to it. Like, I'm not thinking that I'm going to repress it forever, but it feels like I'll get to a place in my life where everything is peaceful and zen and I can take all of my trauma from this like cute little shelf and unpack it nicely and sort through it. And it took a while to realize that time is never going to happen, that fantasy thing that I have. And being in a relationship and witnessing how much my inability to just like tap into what I want or like tap into how I'm feeling just like hinders me in every way. I think that's been helpful. I think I need to logically see how repressing isn't working for me. And then logically I'll try to change it. You know, I'm never going to feel like feelings are a good idea, but I can logically see how not tapping into my feelings is making my life hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That
now,
makes sense.
Is that something you were raised with, or is that something you kind of came across in your journeys growing up, basically?
I think it's something that I've come into.
Yeah.
It's also witnessing family members and people that grew up in a similar way to me, how detached they've become from their emotions in a way that like I can witness how toxic and awful it is and how it makes people in their life feel. Not that they can't change, but it's a little scary to see. It's scary to think about how much work they need to do to tap back into it. And I think I don't want to wait to get to a place where the feelings and emotions are so, they've floated so out to sea mm-hmm. that it would take, I would need to move mountains to tap back into it. Mm-hmm. So I think it's kind of a cautionary tale. Some of them are so far gone that I'm like, I don't know what you would do or what you need to do to like get grounded in yourself again.
Mm-hmm. It's yeah. like, we're just not really raised with it.
I feel like the majority of my extended family, that's why you word it perfectly, to be honest. It's just like that's how they've always been. And at a certain point, that's how they always will be.
Yeah. I don't want to become an old dog.
Yeah. You really do have to like choose to tap into that. And I feel like a lot of people, they just, I don't know. It's just like, for them, it's like a way to like protect themselves. Mm-hmm. From like, yeah. you know, which you can't really blame them if you've gone through a lot of shit. If you're an immigrant or a person of color in this country, like it's easier to protect yourself than have to kind of deal with all the, you know, trauma and generational trauma and just bullshit that you're constantly handed living in this country on all levels of life, from just like the color of your skin to like healthcare. You know, there's
for sure. The basics.
Yeah. No one's here for you. So it's like, yeah, sometimes you got to really just shut it all down. But I don't know. It's an unfortunate cycle to be stuck in that I wish, you know, like our family members were more willing to explore, truly just as simple as it is, just like explore certain emotions and feelings they have without yeah. being like, it's not appropriate.
You're I think
it's honestly the only appropriate thing you can do.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Go to therapy, everybody, please. Yeah.
But I also think that like, and this is not the same for every culture or immigrant story, but I feel like a lot of people of color that move here, they have a survival mentality, you know? They're not thinking of, it's almost selfish of them to be like, how am I feeling? Like their priority is their family and getting a job and staying in America and all those other things. And I think it's really sad because I think it makes them either unconsciously or consciously like not listen, like not acknowledge their feelings. And yeah. that's how they cope, you know? And they all have a lot of trauma in different ways. Everyone does. But I think And this is so sad because in their mission to give their children a better life, they really had to like close off in a lot of ways. And that's depressing.
Well, and it's so fear based in that, like, even some members of my family have a lot of judgment about me moving to the continent and working here and a lot of fear about what's going to happen to me. And not in a danger sense, but in the idea, like, an ideological sense. Like we right. worked really hard to raise you in the culture, to make you a certain way, to make you grounded, because so many Hawaiians are a part of a diaspora. There's this fear that you're just going to forget and you're going to assimilate and you're going to become American and you're going to forget where you're from. And so there's not a lot of trust that I myself am also thinking about those things and I care about not just giving over to assimilation. And I think everybody has to create a daily practice for themselves because it is so easy to just, I mean, capitalism, like, you know what I mean? Like to just like lean into it.
Yeah. Long story short, capitalism.
Capitalism. That's 100%. The end all be all, really.
Unfortunately. God, I fucking hate it.
Yeah. Well, what are you going to do?
What are you going to do? Just cower.
Yeah. Truly. Or just be like a huge bitch. I like doing that about everything.
That's a daily practice.
I already said I want to fight all the time. Where do you think the anger comes from? A lot of places.
It's actually quite fun sometimes to just be like a real fucking monster about everything. Because you know what? I have no choice, okay? These are the cards I was dealt, and I have to deal with it by being a huge bitch, okay? I do want to talk about your podcast because this is actually, I believe Lauren connected us originally. And I assume is because she's wrote it in the email, was because we were talking about the show White Lotus recently on a podcast episode, which I enjoyed the show for what it was of like, it's just a comedy. I can't really think too much more deeper into it because like, I'm not expecting these white people who made this show to really know what's up.
And I'm just a Jennifer Coolidge fan. She makes me laugh so hard. She's so funny. I don't know. Something about just like the sadness she's able to like emanate makes me laugh mm-hmm. so hard. It's just, God, she's so good at playing that character.
Yeah.
But yeah, we were kind of talking about that. And then in the context of like the Hawaiian people and like what's going on in like Maui with like them basically turning off the water. So like, you know, turning off the water for like the citizens while tourists are like living it up. And then we also just, did someone send it to us? Yes, someone sent it to us. I'm sorry, I can't recall. That they're like, they want to build like a wave pool, some sort of like water park situation within yeah. Maui, which is just like another
near
thing.
The wow. beach.
Yeah, you're like, okay.
God forbid you use the yeah, nature like made waves right out, into right nature. Over there.
That's just despicable.
Yeah, and so I kind of want to talk about your show. They called me Hapa. Is that my saying? That
yes.
Right? Hapa?
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Can you tell us a little about what the show is?
Yeah, so They Called Me Hapa was the result of a grant that we got from the Smithsonian Asian Pacific American Center, APA Center. And their goal is mostly to provide students with like engaging experiences that teach them how to become storytellers and media makers and become the narrators of their own story. So that's kind of the cornerstone of it, is that it centered around this workshop that we did in person in Hawaii with a group of students ages 12 to 17. We taught them skills around media making, production, script writing, narration, but we kind of connected all of those skills to this central idea of the word hapa. And so hapa is, have you guys heard of the word before?
Yeah.
No, I haven't.
I grew yes. up with, my school had a lot of, my high school, and my community was like very Filipino, very different kinds of Asian. And so I heard that term a lot, me and my sisters. And it was almost like, I don't know how fucked up this is, but it was almost like a desirable to like be half something else. And
yeah.
so they were using it as like a, like you're better because you're half kind of
yeah.
thing. Or like, I remember Keanu Reeves got called a hapa a bunch, and I'm obsessed with Keanu Reeves.
Yeah.
But stuff
Who
like
isn't?
That is what I remember. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. So I learned when I was creating the curriculum for the workshop that non-Hawaiians use the term hapa. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
And we found out kind of in our research developing, like, what are we going to show the kids? What are we going to have them talk about? All their discussions. So essentially, hapa is a trans alliteration of the English word half.
Mm-hmm.
And half hapa. And they used it in mathematics and in schools. And then at some point, we don't totally know how, but it started to just be used as a word to describe people that were part Hawaiian and part something else. Mm-hmm. So like hapa haole or hapa Hawaiian. But the intent is that you would use it for, the person would need to be Hawaiian and something else, not white and black or Mexican mm-hmm. and Russian. But in the 1990s, this group of Japanese students from UC Berkeley started the Hapa Issues Forum, which talked
wow.
about kind of their struggles with being part Asian in America and not only the feelings that they felt being isolated in their community of UC Berkeley, but some of the acceptance that they were craving in the Asian community, not
right.
being 100%, not being fully accepted, being
right.
too light or too dark. And we basically asked the kids how they felt about this word being used amongst the Asian community. And we used references from things like the Hapa Issues Forum and Hapa Mag. We talked about like movies that took place in Hawaii and kind of looked at what experts are saying about the word and the feelings around it. And so They Called Me Hapa is really limited series that takes the listener through that workshop, and you'll hear the kids and their answers, but we'll pause throughout the show and ask you to journal some of the same prompts the students journaled. So it's kind of an audio experience that's in podcast form.
Wow. That sounds fascinating. I would have never thought to create that. I love that.
Thanks. Yeah, it was an experience because I'm dealing with my own emotions about it. Then you have the kid. I didn't want to imbue those feelings on the kids. Like you wanted
right.
to have them feel free to come to whatever conclusions that they wanted to come to. But there is a lot of And so ironically, even though the grant was from the Asian Pacific American Center, a lot of what we ended up talking about in the workshop is how the Asian Pacific Islander label kind of hides us from representation. And a lot of the label comes from like the convenience of trade in the United States. Mm-hmm. And it's the kind of label that feel like it's as similar as saying Nigerian Americans and Russians. Like, I'm not sure what we have to do with each other. We aren't connected. Our cultures aren't similar. But it's this kind of convenient label. But it's always awkward because it always ends up really being about the Asian community and not the Pacific Islander. Mm-hmm. So it's a strange label.
Yeah, I didn't realize that it started in Hawaii until just now. I just thought it was just like, I understand that the students at Berkeley kind of broadened it out.
Yeah.
Maybe that was the one I was familiar with. That's the history of it all. It always starts from somewhere.
Yeah. Well, and I think the hard part is that it really speaks to, like, most Hawaiians are also part Asian.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So then it kind of perpetuates this idea that Asian is Hawaiian.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, there's just lots of biracial Hawaiian Asian mm-hmm. people. So yeah.
We have to take another quick break, but then we'll be right back and we'll talk about this a little further.
And we're back. So actually, I wanted to talk to you a little about like how I honestly, like I never really read anything about White Lotus or any of the think pieces because my brain is like, I can't analyze this fucking show. There was so much about it that I was like, I don't know anything. I just want to, you know, I just wanted to laugh and then, you know, remove it from my, what is it?
Well, I didn't even get to watch the show.
Fully. You didn't watch the show?
No, yeah. I've only watched the first episode.
What were your thoughts on the first episode? Just out of curiosity.
I think it had, there's a quality to it that's surrealist. So it's difficult to not kind of like honor the surrealism and take it as a reflection of real life. I don't know. I'm a little bit more forgiving in situations where it's like it's not meant to be a reflection of real life. I feel like you get a little bit more leeway. Yeah, I've been avoiding think pieces as well because I do want to kind of go in with some fresh eyes and see what I really think of it.
Yeah. No spoilers here.
I mean, it does have that, like, it almost is like a filter of like dreaminess to it that you're like, who are these people and what is going on? Like, what is this weird? Like, you have to take a boat to this resort. Like, it almost felt like it was its own island, like, made-up island that they were, like, putting in Hawaii. But, like, it was, like, almost like they were going to, like, I don't even know, like, a dreamland.
Yeah.
A part of me, when I was first watching it, I was like, I wonder if this is, like, these people just, like, fell asleep and they're dreaming all this. I had all these theories because everything feels so, like, truly, like, it's like they put, like, a yellow filter over it, which kind of gives it, like, a more surreal energy to it.
Yeah.
It kind of reminded me of, I don't know why, but who's the producer that's doing all those Netflix thrillers, like Ratchet? And I think maybe he does like American Horror Story.
Ryan
like
Murphy.
It's always, yes. Mm-hmm. There was something about it that kind of felt similar to his work in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I think it was kind of wild that people were watching White Lotus and then we heard about the Maui situation and how water was being given to tourists and the show was all about tourism and everything. So I think that skewed my view a little bit of the show. I just have to take it as like a piece of entertainment and like they do make a social commentary, which I appreciate at one point, but I think it would be hard for me to watch something if it was like a series, like if Syria was being visited by tourists, I feel like I would be uncomfortable watching that. So I don't know. I just like, it's a fun, smart show, like as a story.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something about it that I'm just like, I don't know how I feel about XYZ.
Yeah, it's hard to, it's also like I'm so used to like Hawaiian film really existing in a certain, it exists in a certain arena of films. Like, it's a lot of falling in love on the beach, like kind of a 50 First Dates or like a surf movie.
Yeah.
Or there's The Descendants with Clooney. But it's all kind of this, it's all centered around like white actualization.
Yeah.
And like blossoming into the human that they were meant to be with the aid of the waves and the beaches. And then they leave feeling warm and fuzzy. And I don't know, they don't drink anymore. Or they stop their vice. So it's odd.
Yeah. It's definitely odd. Yeah, it's true. You don't really see movies. I mean, I can't even like think of a movie that's not like at a resort.
Or like about white people.
Or about like someone like visiting and like discovering Hawaii. And like,
yeah.
Oh my God, I met this guy.
You're like, he's so exotic. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, it's the closest we have is really Moana, which it's a shame. Yeah. It's already a Disney.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it has to be animated. So like all the characters are like right. cute.
Like, yeah.
Okay. I mean, and who knows about the voice actors too? I don't know. I think the girl was...
Yeah, we went to high school together, actually. She's much younger than me. Much younger. Wow. So we're not friends in any way.
That's wild.
But yeah, we did go to the same school.
Interesting.
And who... I think The Rock is in it, I think. I don't know. It's been a minute since I've seen it.
The Rock is a voice. What is The Rock?
He's a man.
Samoan.
Oh.
Yeah.
No, I was just like,
that too.
What ethnicity is he? He's a man.
Yeah, I believe he's... Yeah, Samoan.
And he's Samoan Black. I think.
How do you, this is maybe going back to something we've already talked about, but how do you feel about the term Hapa? Like, how do you, is it weird having that be the title of a show and like needing to say it a lot or being, or like us even saying that word? Like, I don't, like, how do you feel about it when you hear it?
There's nothing wrong with the word. Like, it's not an offensive word at all. And it doesn't inherently make me feel anything. I think the thing that makes me a little uncomfortable is how it's being used in the Asian American community.
Yeah.
Because, and I think it's even the use of it, like it's being used as this rallying cry for, we want to be seen as whole, autonomous, and valuable people. We don't want to be seen as less than or half caste or all those negative stereotypes about being biracial. Like, we don't want that. So we should be proud. And there's this project by this guy, Kip Fulbeck, who the project is called Part Asian, 100% Hapa. This kind of like radical cry for representation. And there's this irony to me about like wanting to be valued and seen and appreciated for who you are. So then you borrow a term from another culture that's being devalued and underappreciated and oppressed.
Yeah, it sounds just contradictory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's strange, and if people listen to the show, you'll hear in episode 3, we pull some clips from this World of Words podcast where they are investigating this, the word Hapa, and it's under the guise of this girl like happens to know a journalist, so then they're doing this episode on Hapa, and allegedly someone heard her use the term in a grocery store and said that that's offensive, like it's inappropriate for you to use it if you're not Hawaiian. And so the whole episode, they investigate and they talk to different scholars and all these different perspectives. And it's split, but they have a bunch of Hawaiian scholars saying that it's offensive and you shouldn't use it. And at the end, she's like, well, I think that, like, I value that perspective. And if someone finds it offensive, I won't use it in front of them. But words are powerful, but it's just a word. So I'm going to keep using it.
What ethnicity is this person?
I think she's Chinese white.
Well, that's the thing. Like, well, the context that I grew up with hearing that term was like, I'm not going to lie, like aesthetics. Like, oh, this person's hot. It's because they're a Hapa.
Yeah.
Or like, but I understand why some Asians that might be like not fully like 100% in quotes Asian might find that term desirable. Because that's the, I mean, I even thought that when I was like 14, you know what I mean? Like, just because my friends were saying it that way. So.
Well, and what's weird is like, it still in Hawaii, it does kind of mean that too, in that like it is a compliment and there are like Asian undertones to that. So like there is this kind of desirable look in Hawaii, which is like you have kind of light hair and you're and you're very tan, probably more tan than the standard here. You're very tan and you surf and you look good in a bikini and you're probably wearing gold Hawaiian bracelets and you have a flower in your hair. So, I mean, there are aesthetics associated with it, even in Hawaii, but it's kind of like you have this desirable local girl look. So like you're not too native, which usually means you're mixed with some Asian. So your hair is straight. It's not curly.
Right.
You're skinny and you're... So it has that connotation as well. And then you kind of combine it with the already kind of toxic conversation around biracial people in the United States. You know, that they're hot and they're the best of both worlds, whatever that means.
Yeah. It's so, I mean, this is a subject we can dive into for so long, but like I've been thinking a lot about how in so many cultures, having whiteness in your genes is like desirable. Like that might mean blue eyes or straight hair or whatever. It's almost like everyone's trying to be almost racially ambiguous, like ethnically ambiguous. And then it also applies to fucking 100% white people that are also trying the same thing. Like they get like Ariana Grande or like all these people are just like completely painting their skin and pretending to be in quotes exotic or racially ambiguous, or this fox eye trend, which is like emulating Asian eyes that they have gotten scrutinized about, or like even like BBLs. There's like history about that being very like,
what's BBL?
Like almost like, what's it stand for?
Brazilian butt lift.
Brazilian butt lift. It's like the thing that the that's why the Kardashians look like not human.
Oh yeah, that thing I got recently. I'm just joking.
But like, it's so interesting. It's so interesting that both sides of it are trying to meet in the middle, and both of those are. I mean, I think the white thing is more damaging on the white side.
You could just do a BBL. I'm so sorry. This is fascinating. Yeah.
Well, it's really dangerous.
Yeah, it's one of it's one of the most fatal surgeries, and it's become very popular. And people go like abroad to do it or whatever. There's an entire like TikTok community where people post their experience and like saving up for my BBL and all this stuff. Like, I'm kind of fascinated with plastic surgery and the reasons why people do it. So I'm kind of like really interested in that world, and that's why I kind of know about all these weird trends. And most of them are from basically like appropriating other cultures' features.
Yeah.
But big lips is another one. But
I was literally watching a video essay about that earlier today, about this kind of, it's an evolution of the video vixen kind of look. But even in like the early aughts, that even that was a much more realistic version of the hourglass body. Like if you have a huge butt, you likely have other, you know, you usually have wider set hips. You're going to have like bigger thighs at the top. And this is kind of like a version of, it's beyond people that have naturally hourglass figures, because that exists. It's like a slim figure.
It's like slim thick or like something. Because you want the big butt, like not me, but like society tells you should have a big butt, a so tiny waist, but also have a thigh gap.
Yeah.
So it's like, that
doesn't exist in the wild.
It doesn't exist. Like if you have a big butt and you work out, you're going to have big thighs. Usually, either way, you'll have big thighs to support your big butt, which is beautiful. And just the standard of beauty is so ridiculously unattainable and appropriating from so many different cultures into one, like fox eyes, big lips, like hourglass, whatever. All these features that like are not desirable. I used to like, my hips aren't even that big, but I was self-conscious about having big hips growing up. Now it's like the whole thing. And I'm just like, what? And that's so minor compared to like the appropriation of Black culture and like Asian culture and stuff. But oh my God, I can rant about this all day. I'm going to shut up. But
no, I mean, I'm with you. I think, and it speaks to how much growing up somewhere can impact your self-esteem and your understanding of yourself and your ability to go through life comfortable and self-assured. And you know, growing up in Hawaii, I didn't feel crazy dark, but I always thought that I was dark. And then coming here, I've never felt... I was in New York once walking home from the gym at like 6 o'clock in winter. And this guy, like this asshole, came up to me on the street. And he was hitting on me. And he said, do you think... It was a Black guy. And he said, do you think that like ebony and ivory can like get something going. And I was like, are you, am I ivory? It's such a, I have never ever thought of myself as ivory.
Wow.
Which I'm not, objectively. But
yeah, that's not true.
How would my self-image, just like growing up in a place where beauty standards are different?
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea. I think drastically different.
Drastically, yeah. And it's like a subconscious thing that you just like hold on to as a kid, teenager, whatever. Like, yeah, I was terrified of getting darker growing up. It's, yeah. It was so sad. I was like afraid of the sun. I would hide in the shade. It's like depressing.
I think that's so common in almost all minority cultures.
Mm-hmm.
Like you want to be the fair one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you're taught like that's, well, I mean, that's all just stems from like aggressive white supremacy, just like coursing through our veins. Ooh, just that crisp white supremacy in my blood.
Yeah. Like Eurocentric features, like a small ass, like a very particular looking nose, very light skin or whatever. Like in a lot of cultures, that's like the thing. And then we're taught that like sometimes our big noses are not cute, even though they are. It's just like all in our head.
Yeah. I will say like the whole concept that we have to just exist, incredibly toxic.
Yeah.
I mean, like if I've learned anything in therapy, like the fact that I have to just live through all this, toxic.
Yeah. It's a lot.
And not get paid for it.
There's
no boundaries to existence. Yeah. And that is not okay.
That's really not. That's a really good point. And I think it's a great place to end on. Hina, where can people find you on the internet and where can they follow you and your work?
Yes. So you can subscribe to They Called Me Hapa on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. You can check out other projects that Salted Logic is doing at saltedlogic.com. And you can follow me on the socials at Hina Rising.
Beautiful. Thank you again for being on our show and being so open and to, unfortunately, being the role of educator here. I hate
to put you in that position.
Thank you for walking us through and teaching us so much. And I appreciate your time.
Thank you, guys,
for joining us.
And with that, this is Ethnically Ambiguous. It's Ethnically Amb, A-M-B on Twitter, and Ethnically Ambig, A-M-B-I-G on Instagram. I am Shireen. It's Shirohiro on Instagram and Shirohiro666 on Twitter.
I'm just at Anna Bosnier on Twitter.
Until next time, learn about Hawaii.
Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.